This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Our guest, Lauren Grodstein, who teaches creative writing at Rutgers University, calls herself a reluctant atheist. She writes that in difficult times, she has often wished she could believe in God, but she just can't do it. Her new novel, The Explanation of Everything, is about a biology professor, Andy Waite, at a small New Jersey college who is an atheist. He teaches a class called There Is No God. His certainty is challenged by a student named Melissa Porter, who believes in the literal interpretation of the Bible. She wants him to be her supervisor on a research project about intelligent design. Lauren Grodstein had a student like Melissa who believed the earth was 6,000 years old and was smart and creative and sophisticated. I couldn't dismiss her, Grodstein has said. The book explores Darwin, creationism, belief and grief, love and forgiveness. And Lauren Grodstein is director of the MFA program at Rutgers University across the river in Camden. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd love to have you begin with the very first page of your brand new book.
Thank you. Okay. The first time Andy met Louisa, she was covered in blood. He was a bit bloodied himself, having just suffered a minor bicycle accident where Nassau intersects with Mercer and nobody can see himself coming or going. It was a Sunday morning in 1994, and Andy was wearing the ridiculous clothing he'd let himself get talked into by the cute sales girl, purple spandex shorts and a black and silver nylon shirt. Anyway, he'd been daydreaming, yes, but he was reflexively careful at that intersection. And then an Audi out of nowhere, some cursing, an unnecessary ambulance. And now here he was, cradling what was almost certainly a broken wrist and thinking about his dissertation and the way the Mercer County emergency room smelled like urine and paint. The orange plastic chair was hard under his butt. His bicycle-friendly spandex shorts offered no padding whatsoever.
And that's the very beginning of the book where Andy meets Louise, or Lou, who be Louisa, I should say, who becomes his wife.
She does.
I don't think I'm giving too much away by the second chapter. He's a widower.
Yes, yes. But quickly, he, they were married. They had two small girls. And then running out for McDonald's one night before she managed to get the seatbelt buckled, the drunk kid from their apartment complex rammed into her. And ever since then, Andy's life has really been about making sure that the kid who did this stays in jail, raising his two girls, teaching his quiet little classes, and not making too much trouble.
And all those things happen.
Yes.
How important is it for a novelist, especially for that first page or that first paragraph to be as close to perfect as you can?
It is the most important thing. And when I'm teaching, I often make my students, we'll spend an entire day on first sentences.
Really?
Yeah,
first sentences?
Yes, not even the paragraph, because the first sentence not only sets the tone for the book, but it also is what, you know, you're standing in a bookstore, or these days, I guess, you're on your computer and you're thumbing through what to read. People are busy, man. So if you don't give them something good in that first sentence with our attention spans, the way they've been trained to turn off, you know, they're not going to read it. So I find I put more effort into my first sentences sometimes than any other sentence in the book.
This is your first sentence. The first time Andy met Louisa, she was covered in blood.
Yeah.
So how long did it take you to write that first sentence?
It took quite some time because, you know, on the one hand, well, first of all, I broke a rule because the verb was as a form of to be. That's not quite as interesting as you want it to be.
Oh,
on the other
right?
hand, yeah, you know, you want a more active verb. On the other hand, blood, you know, that's pretty good. And although there's not a lot of wanton violence in this book, I thought maybe I could tantalize a few people by suggesting there might be.
And the idea is you want your reader your book.
You want your readers to read the book. What I really want is for them to not stop reading the book. Someone to start reading the book is great. Someone to finish the book is much better.
But you've written a book about Darwin, intelligent design, creationism. I mean, that could be a polemic.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, it could be, you know, people making speeches about all these really heady ideas.
Right. But what could be more boring than that?
Well, exactly.
Right? Yeah, I'm not sending anyone to the classroom or to church. And I'm never, I'm interested in ideas novelists usually are or should be, but I'm even more interested in people. So what really animated this book was trying to figure out why people believe what they believe and why they need to believe what they believe, especially because what we believe, I think, evolves as we grow older. I've met lots of people who are religious in their youth, but are not anymore, and vice versa. And I myself have had a sort of, kind of a windy road through my own series of beliefs. Mm-hmm. When I've needed faith, I've been relieved that it's been there for me. When I've needed a faith community, which I still do, I'm very relieved it's there for me. And my belief in a supernatural God is only a small part of my greater religious experience. Anyway, I was not interested in making any of these characters mouthpieces for one side of a debate. I just wanted them to explore the variety of religious faith.
I called you a reluctant atheist in my introduction. Yeah. Is that correct then?
Well, wouldn't it be wonderful? Well, look, to me anyway, it would be wonderful if there was a supernatural being looking out for me. If I knew that I'd be reunited with the people that I've lost after death. If there was some grand purpose that perhaps was beyond my understanding and yet, you know, was out there for somebody to find one day. All of that, I find those ideas tremendously reassuring and unfortunately profoundly unlikely.
You don't believe them?
I don't believe them. I wish that I could. And I've seen how those sorts of, my husband is from a religious family, and I've seen how those beliefs have really provided such comfort to members of his family, you know? So the reluctance in the atheist part is that although I don't believe in God, I feel that life would be nice perhaps if I did.
To some trust, I mean, the idea of trusting in some supernatural being that had perhaps your best interest at heart.
Or any interest at all.
Even good, bad, right.
Or had gotten the whole ball rolling so that there was some kind of grander plan, because I think what these characters wrestle with, or some of them, that there was no point, that Lou could live and die and have children and it wouldn't matter. And who knows what matter even means, really, but that there should be something but beyond us that gives significance to our lives. That's tremendously comforting.
I read that in part that the Dover, Pennsylvania case was one of the, if I can say, inspirations for this book, but there was a case that interested you, frankly, interested and riveted much of the country, having to do with a school board in Dover, Pennsylvania, that wanted intelligent design to be part of the science curriculum.
Right.
It went to a federal judge. Judge Jones was on the show many, many years ago to talk about it. Such an important case and such an important decision that he made, but nonetheless spoke, I think, to this whole idea about belief.
Very much so. And what's so interesting is that although that case, Kitzmiller v. Dover, it was litigated here in Pennsylvania, it's still being litigated, right? In the Times this weekend, there was something about, you know, teaching evolution in Texas, creationism in Texas. So what that case was about, for those, I'm sure your listeners know, but the case was about a school board that wanted to insert into the ninth grade biology curriculum a statement saying that Darwinian evolution is just a theory, and that another theory or an alternative is intelligent design. What intelligent design, though, really is, it's not science. It's a way to sort of paint religion in scientific garb. But it has no business in a classroom, and for every reason from scientific to constitutional. I mean, religion should not be in science classrooms. So when this case, you know, like so many other people, I found this case fascinating. And as someone who believes in the separation of church and state, a public school graduate, and, you know, a future parent of a child in a science class, I never, ever would want religion introduced into a science classroom. But as a novelist, I was fascinated by the people who were trying to do this. It's not interesting to me to just see them as bad guys or to see them as somehow nefarious, but it's interesting to me to think they thought they were doing the right thing. They thought that they were enlarging these students' understanding of the world. They thought that they were introducing these students to a supernatural being who cared about them. That's not inherently evil. What they were trying to do, again, I very strongly disagree with, but as a novelist, I was very curious about why they were trying it.
So what you have created is this biology professor who is an atheist, teaches a class called There Is No God, and he's very certain about this, and he does have a student, Lionel, who has taken the class several times and challenges him. They have these interesting debates, and then in wanders his student, Melissa, who wants him to be her supervisor for her project on intelligent design. So you've sort of set this up
from
the Dover case into fiction form.
Very much so, right. And so Melissa asks him, you know, would he take on intelligent design? And he says, of course not. This is not a scientifically provable theory. And she says, well, nothing is. Darwinism is a theory, too. And this gets actually to a heart, to some of the heart of what's at this debate, which is just the word theory.
Right.
When scientists use the word theory, they don't mean something that can't be explained or that hasn't been explained. The theory of gravity, as he says in the book, is not up for debate, although we still call it the theory of gravity. The theory of evolution is actually not up for debate. You know, scientists, credible scientists across the world know that evolution is the truth. He tries to explain this to her, but what she says to him is that if you say that evolution is all that we have, and we don't open ourselves to the possibility that there's a greater force than ourselves, then where is the wonder? Where is the hope? Are we all as predetermined as the mice in your lab? Is there no sense that we are here for a greater purpose? So what she's doing, of course, is what a lot of people do, which is to find in religion sort of the locus for the points of humanity, you know, the whole purpose. And he rejects that, but not immediately.
No, not immediately. And we don't want to give too much away. But do you think that also speaks to a view that atheists don't have wonder?
Yes.
Or don't have hope,
yes.
Or don't enjoy art, yes. Or even going into a church,
yes.
And seeing a stained glass window.
Yes. And I think that one of the reasons, you know, people are very reluctant to call themselves atheist, I think, or I can't imagine like a political candidate saying, I'm a proud atheist. You can't get away with that.
You would not get elected.
I don't think so. And it's because, in part, I think that people who assume that if you can't believe in God, then some part of you is shut down. And some part of you is emotionally perhaps unavailable, or that you're just a bad person in general. Because if God is where all that is good resides and you don't believe in that, then what does that say about you? My response to that is that I believe very strongly that good exists in all of us, that we are all living in a constant struggle to be good. I love art. I've sat in churches for hours and admired them and admired the remarkable, you know, religious literature and music. And so my atheism, I don't think, has shut out joy from my life. But people assume that it might, to the point where my mother knows I'm an atheist, or I assumed, thought so. And then she read an interview and she said, you told the world you're an atheist. And I was like, well, yeah, you know, and just like I told the world I have a kid and I live in New Jersey, it's all, you know, she said, well, I don't know if people are going to like that.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with atheist and writer.
Don't tell my mother.
Yeah, but we won't tell your mother. Lauren Grodstein, our guest. She's the director of the MFA program at Rutgers University in Camden. And I know she's an atheist because she's been telling us, but also in some of her writing about her new novel called The Explanation for Everything, she's talked about belief and some of the issues that she has struggled with. And we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. Again, the book is called, a brand new novel called The Explanation for Everything. Stay with us. Call us if you have any questions or comments. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a clinical research trial for adults who suffer from major depressive disorder. If you are between 18 and 65 suffering from major depressive disorder, and if your current medication is not working, you may be eligible to participate in this clinical research trial. Participants will receive investigational drug and study-related evaluations. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or keystoneclinicalstudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
Political cartoonist Tony Auth worked for the Philadelphia Inquirer for nearly four decades before joining WHYY's Newsworks.org. Now experience his work in his new home, WHYY, to stir, inform, and inflame. A thought-provoking exhibition of Tony Auth's work runs now through November 8th. The exhibition was organized by the James A. Michener Art Museum in Doylestown to stir, inform, and inflame. For hours and information, whyy.org/events.
The Resident Ensemble Players, Delaware's professional acting company, supports WHYY. The Rep presents Tennessee Williams, The Night of the Iguana, now through October 13th. Lust and loneliness haunt the life of Shannon, a renegade clergyman on the run, until he meets inspiration in Hannah, the soft-spoken but straight-talking artist who shows Shannon the power and freedom in acceptance. For tickets, 302-831-2204 or DelawareRep.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, Lauren Grodstein is our guest. She's got a new book called The Explanation for Everything. It's about a biologist and widower who teaches a class at a New Jersey college called There Is No God. He also is doing some research on alcoholism, and it's also about his relationship with an evangelical student named Melissa, who is doing some research on intelligent design. Our guest has said the story is really about the belief and about grief, about love and forgiveness. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Well, you had your own, I guess, Melissa Porter, a student that you had who believed the earth was 6,000 years old and really believed many of the things that Melissa in this novel does.
Yes. A student who I'm still close with, who I know her feelings about evolution have in fact evolved. But when we first started talking about these issues, I just met her. She's beautiful, smart, funny, very sophisticated, worldly, in fact, but had been raised in a very devout Christian family and believed that the Bible was not just a religious document, but actually a historical document, or in fact, perhaps even a scientific document, and that in reading the Bible, you could understand how the earth came to be and how we came to be. And this conversation, I'll never forget it. We're sitting at the campus Starbucks, and I almost dropped my coffee, and I was like, what do you mean? How? Because I grew up in the New York suburbs in a sort of liberal Jewish family where, God was maybe out there, but he wasn't a dinner table discussion point.
Did you go to synagogue?
We did for holidays, and I went to Hebrew school, and you know, but I just don't remember sitting around talking about God. He wasn't like a member of the family, shall we say, the way I think that he is for a lot of families. So we talked about this, and I remember trying to change her mind, which is preposterous. Why would I? If this belief animates her, it doesn't mm-hmm. harm me, and yet I felt what I think is a pretty familiar feeling to a lot of either atheists or just people who believe strongly in documented science, that this is wrong and that smart people shouldn't believe this. And how could you believe this? And she said, but it's my faith, and it's what the Bible tells me. It's how I was raised. And then I said to her, look, if you were me and I were you, if you'd grown up in my family, you wouldn't believe this nonsense. And she said, no, I would have found the Bible no matter where I was born. I would have found the truth no matter where I was born. I don't know.
A belief or a certainty on her side.
Completely.
I mean, what I see in this novel are people that with very strong beliefs.
Yes.
On who probably misunderstand each other.
Yes.
To some degree.
Yeah.
Sort of coming together, coming apart. There is no sort of, you know, happy ending, shall we say. And by that I mean sort of the joining of intellectual forces. It's people that struggle to understand the world.
Right. And people, I think, I mean, a big theme in this book is forgiveness. As we talked about before, the protagonist's wife was killed by a drunk driver who was just a teenager when he did this, right? So where do we find forgiveness? How do we learn to forgive people who have done, you know, almost unrightable, truly unrightable wrongs to us? For a lot of people, you find the possibility of forgiveness in faith. But if you don't have faith, how do you learn to forgive? Mm-hmm. Do you have to learn to forgive? I would argue that you do, that forgiveness is part of the capacity to forgive is part of what makes us human. And that quest for just how do we forgive people was also a huge part of writing this book.
And why did that interest you so much? I mean, I think it's something we all have to deal with in one form or another at some point in our life, but why?
Well, I think, you know, this particular, it came from two places. The first is that I live in mortal fear. I spent a good part of from my late adolescence right through 30, I lived in New York City. I didn't drive very often. So the idea of getting behind the wheel and hurt, this is something I think about my own slightly paranoid personality. It was very hard for me sometimes to drive without thinking about all of the terrible things that could come from being behind the wheel, because I think if you don't drive all that often, driving takes on this enormously powerful...
You're aware you
yes!
are driving, right?
I have many tons of metal behind me, and so I think driving for me... And then I had my son, so driving for me in itself just felt like a sort of scary thing. And the idea that if, God forbid, something happened you know, in a car, would there be forgiveness? So that was just sort of one weird psychic tremor that caused that plot point. But the other one is more serious, which is that my grandmother was, in fact, killed by a driver when she was...
A drunk driver?
No. It was the last snowy day of March, 7 years ago. She was crossing the street. She was in great health, but she didn't want to wear hearing aids. And I don't know if she, frankly, I shouldn't say, I don't know if she'd heard what that would have changed. But a car, I think, lost control in the street and struck her. So, she was a very vital, vibrant 82-year-old. And she'd been out shopping for dinner that night because we were all going to see her. So, and this happened in the Bronx. And that was also, and again, you don't know it at the time when these things happen that they'll express themselves in your fiction later. But after that happened, I started going to synagogue. Not because I believed, not because I thought it would make anything better, but simply because finding community, saying the mourner's Kaddish surrounded by other people, and crying, frankly, every time I said it, felt weirdly great. Mm. And in that, I started thinking, I thought an awful lot about the person who had done this. I thought, I hope he's really sorry.
Was it a hit and run?
No, they found out who did it.
They did. Was she killed instantly?
She was.
She was. Oh,
goodness. I thought, I hope he's sorry, and I hope I have the power, you know, at some point to forgive a person I've never met, who I'll never meet. I don't know his name. But I hope that I can forgive him.
Hmm. Do you? Did you? Have you?
I don't know. Not as much as I would like, because the thought of him still makes me pretty mad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is in part what your protagonist, right. what Andy deals with.
Yes.
I mean, he corresponds with this person who killed his wife.
Yes.
I mean, he happened to be young, but he was also drunk.
Yes.
And well-known drunk in the neighborhood.
Yes.
But he engages with him.
Yeah. He was drunk, but he was also a kid. He was a teenager. He's a teenager who made a terrible mistake, a mistake that will haunt him, as they say, for the rest of his life, a mistake that can't be undone. But he was also a kid. And I firmly believe, since I work with a lot of people in their late teens and early 20s, that the mistakes that we make when we're that young shouldn't necessarily have the power to destroy the next 60 years. But for, of course, they've permanently altered and wrecked a lot of the years that Andy has left. So for Andy, a journey of trying to forgive this guy, I think, is important not only because it will help. If he forgives the guy, then maybe the guy will, you know, get out of jail a little bit sooner because he could help in the parole proceedings. But also, Andy might have a better life because if you let go of that stuff, it does feel better.
Well, and the kid that killed his wife, I mean, he gets his degree in jail.
Yeah.
I mean, he's trying to turn his life around.
Yeah, he's trying to make but you know, he has a long life ahead of him, so you try to make it as good as you can.
It's interesting because you talk about the fact that there was a person that did it, that killed your grandmother driving a car.
Yeah.
You haven't quite forgiven that person, but your main character has forgiven.
It's nice to inhabit characters who are better than you are. You know?
Do you feel that way, though?
Of course.
And the fact that you haven't forgiven means you're sort of...
Not that I'm it's not about being better or worse. It's just having a better capacity to do certain things.
Right.
My capacity to forgive is, I like to think, pretty good. You know, if someone hit my car the other day, or not hit it, but just sort of hit my bumper. I looked out the window. She was still on her phone. She said, "Oh, sorry," without even putting down the phone. And I was like, "Okay," as though we had just done this fun thing. You know, we just had a little chat. I forgave her. No harm, no foul. My car is fine. No one was in the car. We're good. With something like what happened to my grandmother, forgiveness is I'd like to be Andy. I would like to find the capacity to forgive eventually. I hope to be him. But Andy got a whole novel to do it. I've only had 7 years.
Yeah. But also, I forget the name of the young man that kills Andy's wife. But, I mean, he is contrite.
He's sad. Oliver,
sad.
Yeah.
Oliver.
And he's trying to make a life for himself. And he wants, you know, very strongly to have the opportunity to live a life that where he, you know, when you're in jail, I think it's hard. I don't know, but I imagine it's hard to do good things or to do make any kind of reparations when you're stuck in a cell.
Mm.
But if he's allowed out, perhaps there's a way to make other people's lives a little better.
Do you know anything about the person who killed your grandmother?
Nothing.
Did he go to jail?
No.
He did not?
No. Wow. No, it was an accident. It was an accident.
Yeah.
Yeah, he skidded.
That complicates things, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, accidents, deadly accidents happen. They happen all the time. They happen to all of us. Well, deadly accidents don't, but certainly people hurt us by accident all the time. Our ability to rise above, to say you're forgiven, is a very powerful thing. And I do try to live my life forgiving and being open to other people's apologies.
That's Lauren Grodstein, our guest today on Radio Times. She's the director of the MFA program at Rutgers University in Camden, across the river here. She's written a book of short stories and several novels, and she's got a new one. It's called The Explanation for Everything, and it covers a whole host of things we've been talking about, creationism and atheism and forgiveness. And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. As you said, it's interesting, after your grandmother was killed, you went to a synagogue, and while you didn't believe, you felt some kind of comfort there. In your novel, Andy is given a book called God is a Rainbow, and he starts to read it, you know, with all the sort of preconceptions and prejudices, I guess, about what this couple is going to say about God and faith and religion, but he can't put the book down.
Yeah, because
he's intrigued. He's sort of enamored of the community that they write about.
Exactly, the community they describe is a very you know, all American, I suppose, community with church picnics and, you know, softball games. And I also think that that's why a lot of Americans are so tied to their churches, right, or their synagogues, or their mosques, whatever. You know, we're so fragmented and we're so separate from each other. And sometimes we, you know, if you live in the suburbs, you can live miles from, you know, sort of a commercial center, places where people gather. So people gather at their churches, and those churches, they find family, they find friendships, they find good lunches and softball games and fellowship. And I think that that's another reason that the church life or religious life is so sustaining to us. And he is really absent from a sustaining life. Ever since his wife died, he's been cut off from the world. So a presentation like the one that they present in this book of a cheerful place with kids and pie, right? How comforting is that? Plus, God loves you. All of that, I think, is if it sounds sarcastic, I don't mean it to. That is, I think, an incredibly comforting idea.
You have a little boy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think about how to create a community for him if you don't go to synagogue or you don't go to church?
I very much. And the reason, one of the reasons we joined a synagogue in Philadelphia is because we were looking for this community. We moved from New York here 5 years ago. We moved to the suburbs. As I said, I didn't love to drive and I didn't know anybody, and suburban life seemed so quiet and strange.
Suburban,
yeah, right, that's the word. You know, and everyone knew each other. I live in this town where, like, people have lived there for 8 million years, and their children live there, their grandchildren live there, and I felt pretty alone and pretty weird, you know. And I'd go to the playground with my kid, and I didn't know anyone, and I started looking for community. And in Brooklyn, as I said, after my grandmother died, I found this comforting community in a synagogue, and I thought, well, my husband found a place online called Cult Tzedek. We went. It was so warm, and I started bringing my son, and we sent him to Hebrew school. And he will say to me, because we've been talking about this book at home, he said, well, you don't believe in God, and you don't believe in Santa Claus. And I said, well, the two aren't exactly the same. He said, well,
but you're a five-year-old.
But right, sure. And he said, well, I believe in God, and I believe in Santa Claus. And I said, and that's just fine.
Right.
Yeah.
He had a tough beginning,
yeah.
Your son. I mean, were there times, and this is shortly after he was born, that you wanted a God
again,
to help,
right?
Explain
so this,
what was going on?
Very much so. So this goes back to the whole reluctance of the atheism thing. So my son was born with some congenital birth defects that were fixed in a surgery that occurred when he was 2 days old. So when that happens, and it was very unexpected. When that happens, I think you look for anything you can find. And I kept looking for something to hold my hand through this. And what I found really, I think, was my dad, who's a physician, mm-hmm. who assured me he'd be okay. And, you know, and the books that I brought to the hospital, which I had imagined I would read while I was nursing, not that I'd read while I was sitting in a, you know, waiting for my newborn to have surgery. My husband, on the other hand, who again grew up in a religious family, said and will continue to say that he saw a great chain from his great-grandparents, his grandparents, anyone he knew who had passed was sitting there in that hospital room watching us. And he believes that completely. So he was able to find in that time some kind of supernatural comfort. I found my dad in a stack of books that I brought. We find what we find, you know?
But was that, science can be comforting.
Very.
Comforting.
Well, the science of the surgery was very comforting, frankly. The science of knowing that babies can get through anesthesia, they heal really fast, that he was not going to remember this, that he, listen, he's had to go, you know, he's perfectly healthy, but he's had to go for like minor fix-up, tune-ups, I guess, to, you know, to different hospitals to chop. And that is not fun. He's old enough to understand and he's old enough to be scared. A newborn, well, what do they know? The next, you know, they were asleep before, they're asleep again, fine. I found the science of what was going to happen to him, the fact that people had done this a million times, it was pretty routine, that was very comforting to me. But my husband didn't even think about the surgeons at all. He thought of
Interesting.
God.
But you both got comfort?
Yeah,
I think in your own way.
I think so. We still don't talk about it a huge amount because we're busy keeping up with a five-year-old. But I wonder, and maybe I'll ask him, I wonder if I know what he'd say. I know he'd say that they were there.
Hmm.
Yeah, that they were watching.
The book is called The Explanation for Everything. And in Andy's class, Andy Waite's class, he puts on the blackboard, evolution is the explanation for everything. Darwin is right. And people who don't believe Darwin are wrong.
Right.
Did the title come to you?
The title?
Quickly,
so I am
easily?
No. I am notoriously terrible at titles. My titles included The Widower Waite, which I thought had, you know, a sort of nice alliterative thing going. I liked The Disbeliever, which I thought was sort of punchy. And my very wise editor said, oh, those are so good, but why don't we think of something better?
How supportive.
Yeah, and she is. She is tremendously supportive. And no, really, I'm blessed with very wonderful publishers. And I'm not blessed with a great gift for titles. So my editor, we went back and forth. My editor came up with this one. I'm very glad she did. Because I think it's provocative. And people, you know, pick it up and, well, you know the explanation for everything? I'd like to find out. And of course, you know, Darwin for Andy is the explanation for everything.
Right.
But for other characters, it's somebody else or something else.
We're almost up in a break here. But did you, I know you're, I mean, you're a novelist.
Mm-hmm.
How much research did you have to do on Darwin? And I mean, Richard Dawkins is in here.
Right.
Other people as well who are living.
Yeah. It was so being a novelist allows you to live a different life, right? You can be anyone you want. Here I was a biologist. I did tons of research. I saw things in mouse labs I will not scare your listeners with. Yeah. But it was so much fun to put on, you know, my biologist smock and research for months, years even.
Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Lauren Grodstein, our guest today on Radio Times, and the book is called The Explanation for Everything. And again, director of the MFA program at Rutgers University across the river in Camden. And we're taking calls. We're covering a whole wide range of issues and territory. Any questions or comments you might have, that phone number again, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health supports WHYY and offers a fully accredited master's degree in public health. An open house will be held at 5:30 p.m. Wednesday, October 2nd in the school's offices on the 10th floor of 901 Walnut Street. Registration online at jefferson.edu/openhouse. Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health. Bringing health and healthcare together.
In the United States, an estimated 5 million children experience domestic violence. Most victims suffer quietly, but there's good reason to speak out.
We decided to raise awareness and put ourselves out there, and when we did, it actually helped us understand what we went through.
On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, helping children exposed to domestic violence. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents Orquesta Buena Vista Social Club Wednesday, October 9th at the Merriam Theater. Seemingly emerging from nowhere in the mid-1990s, the Buena Vista Social Club established itself as an international ambassador for Cuban music, transcending musical styles, fads, and fashion. The group has reunited to tour as the 13-piece Orquesta Buena Vista Social Club, featuring several alumni of the original album and film. Tickets at KimmelCenter.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, Lauren Grodstein is our guest. Her new novel, The Explanation for Everything, is the story of a South Jersey college professor and his challenging student. He's a biology professor, he's an atheist, and an evolutionist. The student is an evangelical who has asked him to oversee her independent study on intelligent design. In their story of their relationship, Grodstein tackles complex issues and themes of loss, of remorse, of parenting, personal beliefs, and life in academia. She teaches creative writing at Rutgers University, also the author of two previous novels and a collection of short stories, and a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Richard from Yardley to join us. Richard, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I just want to testify that there is one, at least one happy atheist out there, which is me. I have a philosophy called appreciative materialism. I just really appreciate the odds of being here, and life is good. And as an atheist, I've got a rich life, and so there are people like me out here.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, Richard, thanks for the call to Radio Times. The idea, I guess maybe the revelation of a happy atheist.
I know, people are shocked. But the truth is that, right, the odds of just being here are so slim. The fact that your parents met each other and that you happened to get born of all the possible children that could have been born from your parents. So, right, the very fact of us being here is a source of wonder if you're looking for one. And then the fact that we are generally happy is another source of wonder, especially when you consider how many hardships there can be. So I agree with that caller that just, I don't remember exactly what he called it, but whatever that philosophy is, sorts of material, of happy material,
appreciative materialism.
Perhaps I will sign myself up for that too.
Richard, thanks for the call to Radio Times. So do you feel like you have a happy life, that you're a happy person?
I am I tell anyone who asks, I'm the luckiest person I know.
Really?
Yeah. I have a healthy kid, right? I'm surrounded by people that I love. I've got a great job with remarkable students. I get up every day, and and it's been sunny, for like 6 days in a row
something like that?
So, yeah. And I get to come and talk about my work. So yes, I'm a pretty happy person.
I also read somewhere that you are pretty much the same person you were when you were eight. And I underline that because I feel in certain ways the same way. I mean, obviously a slightly more sophisticated person, but if you can be that eight-year-old even at any age, I think you can be a happy person.
I think so. I think that one of the sad parts about getting older, which of course I've experienced too, is that you understand that the world is not just complicated, but very unfair. And it's not unfair the way it is to an eight-year-old where someone, got an extra treat and you didn't. It's unfair in profound, unfixable ways. But when I was eight, I loved to read. I loved to write. I loved to make up stories. I loved to hang out with interesting people. I loved to stay up too late. So, in sort of core ways, but especially in ways of making up stories and trying to convince other people they were true, I haven't changed at all.
So when did you start writing stories?
Well, I started making up stories, which isn't quite the same thing, but when I was very young, when I would draw characters on, my mother's an artist, I would take pieces of her sketch paper and actually just draw characters and speak out loud and tell their stories, and people would think I was talking to myself, and when I was old enough to feel self-conscious about it, I would try to do that, quietly.
Mumbling.
But I still didn't stop. And then I learned to write, but writing didn't, so the fact that I could write words on paper didn't stop me from actually trying to verbalize made-up stories, which actually led to me getting in trouble more than once. And I wasn't trying to get in trouble.
Because
and I
you were a liar?
A big liar. I was a huge liar, but I didn't see it as lying. Lying sounds so nefarious. I was like creative. I was like making the world more interesting. So, I would try to convince people that, my dad was from space, and I was using what I thought were very convincing details. I was, you know, coloring in the lines, and nobody would believe me, which I found frustrating, and then I'd keep trying to convince them, and then I'd get in trouble. So I think I had a sort of storyteller's personality, which resulted in a certain storyteller's punishment when I was a kid. But then as I got older, I kept writing. I didn't know that anyone could grow up to actually be a writer. To me, being a writer was like being a rock star. It was like growing up to say, you know, one day I'm going to be, you know, an astronaut or the president. Like, who, you know, that wasn't going to be me. And then when I was a senior in college, someone mentioned that you could get a graduate degree in creative writing, which now everyone's heard of MFA programs. At the time, I hadn't. His sister, in fact, was getting one. She was getting one at one school, and then it turned out that the college I went to also had one, so I applied to the one that his sister went to, and I applied to mine. I didn't get into the sister one. I got into my college's MFA program. I went, and I decided it's been 2 years. I was, you know, right out of college, I was 21. I'd spent 2 years writing, 2 years having fun. And then when it was over, I would, like, pull it together and get a grown-up job or something. Yeah. Actually, my dad said, great, you're going to be a writer? Why don't you be an insurance underwriter? And I didn't know what that was, and I still don't, but it sounded like something that came with benefits, so I would do that. And instead, what happened was it's truly like being discovered in a mall or something. But, you know, I gave a reading at a bar, and an editor was in the room, and he heard me read a story. Yeah, I know. And liked what he heard, and he represented a very small press, and they ended up publishing my thesis, which was my first book, which was a collection of short stories. Uh-huh. So once that happens, once you taste the big time, you know, you can't put that girl back in a corner. So although I certainly had to support myself, I worked as a secretary, and I began that after I finished my MFA program, and I began the habit that I think is the most important, most sustaining habit I have, which is I started getting up early before I went to work.
Like 5 in the morning?
Yeah, like 5 in the morning. I had to get out in the subway, let's say, by like 8, right? So if you get up at 5 and you brush your teeth, you make some coffee, you're probably at your desk by like 5:20. Yeah, you work for 2 hours, you shower, you know, you eat something, and you get on the train. And that habit, more than anything else I've done, is just what's kept me writing. It's just I get up early, I go to sleep. Now I go to sleep early, and now I get up early.
But it's interesting. It doesn't sound like you had the English teacher that said to you in ninth grade, oh, Lauren, you know, I see the makings of a great writer here.
I think, no, I had English teachers certainly supported me and thought I was pretty good at this. When I was in college, I tried to enroll. There was a famous writer who came to campus to teach a seminar, and I tried to enroll in her seminar, and she read the material I gave her, and she said, well, why don't you come back when you're a little bit better?
Ouch.
And I thought, okay. But it was so, but again, like I was so young and sort of dumb, I was like, okay, I'll come back when I'm better. And I did. And, you know, I just, I really love to make up stories, and I really love words, and I really love to read. So I think, unfortunately, for all those parents out there hoping for their kids to do something a little more practical, if your kid likes to tell stories and likes words, there's a sad chance he or she might be a writer.
But do you think being a liar makes for a good novelist, or a good liar makes a good novelist?
Yeah, or a good criminal. But yes, I think that if you have the habit of making stuff up, there's a good chance you, too, can be a fiction writer.
Let me see what looks like Andrea from Westchester has to say. Andrea, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to cycle back to your conversation earlier in the broadcast where your guest spoke about the importance of opening lines in a novel. And I was recollecting when I read The Kite Runner that the first line of that book is, "There is a way to be good again." And it was so filled with hope and wonder and a big question about what is it? You know, how can you do that again? And then I ended up hating the book because you're made to endure such pain and heartbreak, and there's no redemptive end in that novel, and it felt like a trick.
Wow,
so I wondered what your guest and what you, Marty, think about that. If that is just what you were recently talking about, you know, novels being good storytellers and make it up people, just what you think.
Fair enough. Andrew, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Your thought?
Well, I always tell my students, and I firmly believe, that the only obligation a writer has is to the product, is to the story. So I'm never writing to offer hope, and I'm never writing to explain anything despite the title of my book. I am simply writing to tell the kind of story that makes a reader stay up too late, pass, her subway stop, whatever. That said, as a reader, and I'm a very different reader than I am as a writer, as a reader, stories that are entirely bleak, that offer no sense that there's a larger light out there, I tend to get a little bummed out, and I don't love those works as much, although many people do. The stories that I love tend to be, at least offer, sort of dangle some possibility at the end. So I understand completely your sense of despair at a book that doesn't do that.
Yeah, Andrew, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I mean, I like a good opening line, but there has to be there have to be other good lines, obviously,
right,
as well.
Right. And when I talk to my students about who are embarking on novels, I tell them, and I mean it, it's just the most preposterous thing to do, right? Yeah. You're creating an entire world that a stranger has to believe is true. You are making people up who have to act like real people when we ourselves often can't predict what real people will do at any time. You have to create dialogue that sounds like things that people would say, a plot that's somehow interesting. It's very difficult. And when my students have a hard time, I often tell them, listen, it doesn't have to be good. It just has to get done. We'll make it good later. First, the first step is just to get it out there, get those words out there, and then we'll work on making it, doing the harder stuff, which is making it good.
Seems like you like dialogue. There's a lot of dialogue in this book, people in conversation with each other.
Yes.
Does that mean when you're out, you're listening to other people's conversations?
Yes. And I get called on it sometimes, and it's very embarrassing.
Are you taking notes?
I don't take notes. I've learned not to take notes. Also, now I have my phone. If it's really good, I can just write.
So you're not only a liar,
right,
or
I'm
a spy.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, now I'm thinking, and this is going out to the public. I love listening in. I love listening in. I love listening to parents talk to their kids. I love listening to couples, especially when they're fighting. I love listening, to people try to work out in, a tense situation. I listen in a lot, and I've gotten yelled at. What are you looking at? Who do you think, and I back away slowly or pretend I don't speak English when I'm in other countries, I love listening to English speaking tourists try to navigate, and then usually they think I'm a weird local and they leave me alone. But I have, even far away from home, I've gotten a, what are you listening to?
At one point, I think it's your main character says, I miss New Jersey. And I know you grew up there, you left, and now you're back.
Yep.
What's the pull of New Jersey?
I can't think of a better state to write about. Everything I've ever written comes back to New Jersey or is set in New Jersey. New Jersey to me is... it's far beyond the cartoon, cartoonish images that are broadcast. New Jersey is really a microcosm of the entire country. It's incredibly diverse. I think I've heard, and I think this is true, if you took L.A. out of California and New York City out of New York, New Jersey would be the most diverse state in the country.
Oh, wow.
It has a very well-educated population. It has fantastic Indian food. It has beaches and mountains and pine forests. It has... although it's considered a very urban state, it does have rolling hills. And if you want to see the different ways Americans live, you don't have to travel that far when you live in New Jersey. So I can't think of a better place to write about.
But is it also easy to write about because you know it so well? You grew up in it, so you know.
Although I grew up in the New York suburbs. I was born in Brooklyn. I come from a long line of New Yorkers, and so my parents, when they moved to the country, they really moved 8 miles outside of New York City.
Okay.
So when you grow up there, your whole focus, at least in our family, was really New York, to the point where it didn't occur to me that New Jersey had its own governor until I was in high school. I just sort of thought, the people in the city kind of took care of that stuff for us. I moved to New York, and then I came back to New Jersey, and this time I came to South Jersey, which I find a much easier and more congenial place to live. It's beautiful. It's friendlier. It's not, people say, oh, it's slower. It's not that it's slower. It's just not breakneck.
Yeah.
And I also think that being so close to Philadelphia, but without any of the difficulty, like to get from where my parents lived in New Jersey to New York City could take an hour and a half to traverse those 8 miles. For me, if it takes more than 25 minutes, I'm like, oh, this is pretty crazy. And I just love living here.
Mm.
And my kid likes it. And my kid has been lucky enough to because I get to travel a lot. My kid has traveled a lot. He's been everywhere from, Colombia to Holland. He's been everywhere. And if you ask him, as people do, so what's the best place in the world? Expecting he'll say, I love Paris. I love San Francisco. He's like, Moorestown. Which, by the way, lots of Moorestown people would agree.
Yeah, indeed. So are you having next book terrors yet?
unfortunately. So I also tell this to my students, that the only cure for a book coming out is writing a new book. And so I'm trying my first book from the point of view of a woman, which I've never done before.
Oh, really?
And from the point of view of a mother. I think at a certain point, you just got to give in. This is what I do. This is what I know now. I know how it is to be a mother. And so I'm trying it. I'm trying to put it on the page.
But, I mean, how different is it to write from a female perspective versus, I mean, not...
Enormously. Well, for me, because I've always been very, very careful and very adamant, in fact, about separating myself from my characters. I felt like the best way for me to really dive into a fictional world is to remove myself. This time, though, the character that keeps coming back to me is a mother of a young son. For obvious reasons.
I wonder where that came from.
And I think it's just because motherhood is the most all-consuming thing I've ever done. So it's either write about what's consuming me or don't write. Mm. And so I'm writing about that.
And we're almost out of time here, but how much does teaching budding writers help you as a writer?
Enormously. Enormously. First of all, it's great to see other people. You know, when you're lacking enthusiasm, you can borrow some of theirs. And then the other thing is, you know, to get to talk about writing with smart people all day, like, what could be better?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And does it, but by talking about it, does it get you to think about, well, how maybe things that you're trying to figure out how to write at 5:30 in the morning?
Very much so. Yeah. And it's also, it's a great way when you don't feel like writing at 5:30 in the morning, you'll be like, well, you know what, I think I have to read some student work, so I better just do that instead. So not only is teaching my favorite procrastination method, but it's also a way to sort of remind myself, like, I was there once, I've done all this, I can probably do it again.
Well, Lauren Grazian, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for joining us, and congratulations on the book as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The book is called The Explanation for Everything. And again, Lauren Grazian, our guest, she's the director of the MFA program at Rutgers University at the Camden campus. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.